Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have reactions from East County Congressional Representatives on two controversial Supreme Court rulings that blocked student loan forgiveness and eroded protections for the LGBTQ community. Then we'll have a special report on toxic algae off the California coast, including San Diego, and what that means for the health and safety of wildlife, pets, and people in our region. A new report from SANDAG has found that most people arrested in San Diego County are using methamphetamines and often other drugs, and we'll have details on our show today. The county has issued a revised environmental impact report on that controversial cottonwood sand mine proposed along the Sweetwater River in Rancho San Diego, next to a federal wildlife preserve, and there's a public meeting coming up later on this month. From California News Service, we'll have a report on the impact on students who have lost CalFresh benefits this summer. Then on Crime Beat, hear about a 7-hour SWAT standoff at a Santee Walmart with an axe-wielding suspect, as well as a deadly shooting in Spring Valley and a man arrested for assault and arson in Lemon Grove. Today, we are pleased to introduce a talented new host of East County Magazine's Bookshelf, local author Annette Tour. Be sure to stay tuned for her fascinating and important interview with Thomas Gabor, co-author of American Carnage, Shattering the Myths That Fuel Gun Violence. You'll probably be surprised at what you'll learn about the history of gun laws in America and his findings on mass shooters as the deadly toll from such incidents continues to rise in the U.S. On Destination East County, hear about some fun festivities coming up across San Diego's inland region, including a camel farm tour in Ramona, Pine Valley Days and the Pine Valley Parade, Team on a Trek at Grossmont Center, a Star Fest in Julian, Cajon Classic Cruises, Santee Summer Concerts, and the Mount Helix Food and Wine Festival. Plus, as summer heats up, we'll have some grilling safety tips for you. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Derek Wilton with a Capitol Report. The Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. issued two controversial decisions on Friday, June 30th. By a 6-3 vote, the conservative majority found that President Joe Biden lacked authority to forgive student loans. The court also ruled that a Christian web designer can refuse to create websites for same-sex couples, an action that eliminates civil rights protections enacted by many states for the LGBTQ+ community and potentially other protected groups. Those cases cap off a week in which justices earlier found affirmative action programs at universities to be unconstitutional, barring preference for racial minorities. What do local representatives have to say about those decisions, and what might the long-term impacts be for students, the LGBTQ+ community, businesses, and minorities concerned about discriminatory state laws? Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, a Democrat, whose district includes East County areas, posted on Twitter regarding the student loan ruling, "Crushing student debt has delayed or denied millions of people's big milestones like buying a house or having kids. President Biden's plan helped relieve this burden, especially for those most in need. This is devastating," she said, "but we'll keep fighting to address the student debt crisis." She also denounced the court's decision eroding gay rights, calling it absolutely disgusting to give businesses the license to discriminate against the LGBTQ+ community and other vulnerable groups, ironically on the last day of Pride Month. "Pride has always been a protest," Jacobs concluded, "and that will continue until there's true equality." But Congressman Daryl Issa, a Republican, praised the court for allowing a business to deny service to an LGBTQ+ couple. In his view, the ruling, quote, "upheld our First Amendment, defending every American's right to think and speak for themselves." ISA also praised the court for ruling affirmative action unconstitutional, noting that he led a similar effort in California to eliminate compulsory quotas by color. In addition, ISA voiced approval of the court's ruling to prohibit the president from forgiving student loans, even though ISA's own company had a federal COVID-19 debt of over $150,000 forgiven. ISA praised the court for finding that only Congress has power to forgive loans, striking down what ISA calls President Biden's purely unsupported student loan bailout. Here are more details on the court's controversial rulings last Friday. In the case filed by the Christian website designer against the state of Colorado, Justice Neil Gorsuch wrote the majority opinion. He wrote that the First Amendment allows that all persons are free to think and speak as they wish, not as the government demands. The Colorado law that prohibited businesses from discriminating against LGBTQ+ individuals was thus unconstitutional. According to Gorsuch, who was joined by fellow conservatives Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Samuel Alito, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Clarence Thomas. Justice Sonia Sotomayor issued a harsh rebuke of colleagues in her dissent, which was joined by federal liberal justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Sotomayor wrote, "When the civil rights and women's rights movements sought equality in public life, some public establishments refused. Some even claimed, based on sincere religious beliefs, constitutional rights to discriminate. The brave justices who once sat on this court decisively rejected those claims." She noted that Friday's ruling marked the first time in the court's history that it granted a business open to the public a constitutional right to refuse to serve members of a protected class, and called recent attacks on LGBTQ+ people heartbreaking. Noreen Farrell, executive director of Equal Rights Advocates, denounced the court for rolling back decades of progress for LGBTQ+ people in what she calls a sad day for justice. She predicts that this will lead to additional discrimination based on race, religion, political affiliation, and more, adding, "It's not hard to imagine the return of signs in store windows that read no blacks or no Jews." When reporters contacted the man listed in the suit, he said he never submitted a request. New Republic journalist Melissa Gira Grant concludes that Smith and her lawyers may have invented a gay couple in need of a wedding website for the cause. As for the student loan case, the Biden administration announced a new plan after the Supreme Court ruled against his administration's effort to forgive some $20 million in student debt for 43 million people. Repayment of student loans were halted during the pandemic, with payments slated to resume in October. The court found that Biden's use of the HEROES Act to cancel student debt exceeded his authority, and that under the act, authority rests with Congress. So late Friday, Biden made two announcements to help indebted students. First is a one-year grace period to begin making repayments. However, interest will begin accruing again starting in September. Second, Biden has proposed a new plan that will utilize the Higher Education Act of 1965 to forgive some student loan debts. That law has a provision that allows the Director of Education, not Congress, to compromise, waive, or release student loans. It is not yet clear which student loan recipients will qualify or how much debt may be forgiven under the newly proposed plan. Those with student loans are encouraged to consult with their loan servicer. In addition, the Biden administration is also considering options that could make it easier for some who are financially unable to repay their student loans to apply to have some or all of their debts discharged through bankruptcy. The process of negotiated rulemaking that could allow the Department of Education to forgive student loans could take a year or two, Associated Press reports, since it requires a public hearing and feedback in negotiated sessions. A virtual public hearing is slated for July 18th. There is precedent, since the Education Department has used the Higher Education Act to cancel student loans in the past on a small scale. Still, this route may also face legal challenges and could ultimately wind up before the Supreme Court.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
The weather in San Diego is heating up, but before you head to the beach, be sure to listen to our special report today. A red tide containing a toxic algae bloom that has sickened and killed hundreds of sea lions and dolphins off the California coast has reached San Diego beaches over the holiday weekend. State forecasts were for levels of the potent neurotoxin domoic acid at double the 500 nanograms per liter, which is considered harmful. That's according to a press release from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. The bloom, which began in early June off Santa Barbara, is the most severe in memory, according to the state's Fish and Wildlife Agency. While not all red tides are toxic, and some aren't even red, depending on the type of algae bloom, this one has killed or sickened hundreds of marine mammals in Southern California in recent weeks, including sea lions and dolphins. The neurotoxin in this bloom induces seizures, brain damage, and death in marine mammals that consume fish contaminated with the toxin. Birds such as cormorants can also become sick and die from eating fish or shellfish contaminated by the toxins. The algae blooms also use up oxygen and prevent light from reading plants on the seabed, potentially harming these as well. Now, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control advises, quote, "The long-term health effects of harmful algal blooms in people and animals remain unclear because we are still learning about the long-term health effects. It's important to take steps to keep yourself and your pets safe, such as not going into water containing harmful algae blooms." Now, the state has not gone as far as urging people to stay out of the water, nor has the county. However, pets should definitely not be allowed to swim in any waters with harmful algae, including the ocean, as well as any lakes or ponds, by the way, that have visible algae scum. The biggest risk to humans from this particular toxic bloom is if a person consumes seafood tainted by domoic acid. Highest risk are filter feeders such as mussels, clams, oysters, and scallops, according to the California Department of Public Health. The toxins can also accumulate in anchovies, crabs, lobsters, and sardines. Seafood can contain very harmful levels of marine toxins, even if you can't see a red tide where they're caught. While commercially sold seafood is regularly tested for these toxins, privately caught or harvested seafood poses substantial risks during these toxic algae blooms. To learn about current advisories in quarantined areas for sport fishing or harvesting shellfish, you can call the Biotoxin Information Line. That number is 800-553-4133. According to state health officials, red tides can also cause irritation of the eyes, mouth, and throat, as well as cold and flu-like symptoms in humans if you do decide to go in the water. Illness believed to be caused by algae toxins should be reported to your local or state health department, which have forums on their websites. Poisoning from eating seafood, such as shellfish or fish contaminated by toxic algae, can cause far more severe symptoms or even death. Symptoms include nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, stomach pain, shortness of breath, irregular heartbeat, abnormal hot and cold sensations, memory loss, disorientation, seizures, and coma. Treatment is important, especially for older people or anybody with kidney disease. Call your healthcare provider for help to manage symptoms, and for details on illnesses linked to toxic blooms, you can also call the Poison Control Center hotline, and that number is 800-222-1222. As for how toxic algae affects animals, the neurotoxin affects the brains of marine mammals and can cause aggressive behavior. There are reports of sea lions attacking and biting swimmers, including one off Del Mar, as well as surfers and sunbathers elsewhere in Southern California. The public is urged to stay away from marine mammals and to report injured and ill marine mammals to the National Marine Mammal Foundation in San Diego. Their website is nmmf.org. That stands for National Marine Mammal Foundation. SeaWorld has also treated some marine mammals sickened by the toxic algae bloom locally, according to CBS 8. Marine mammals can be treated with fluids, food, and anti-inflammatories to flush out toxins, and while some fully recover, other survivors may have long-lasting effects, notably brain damage, according to the Channel Island Marine and Wildlife Institute, USA Today reports. So what's causing the toxic algae bloom, and how long will it last? The bloom off local shorelines is caused by a diatom, that's a form of plankton. Such blooms have been accelerating in recent years, with a 15-fold increase in red tides over the past 50 years, Newsweek has reported recently. Climate change, as well as growing use of chemical agricultural fertilizers that run off into the ocean, are believed to be factors in the disturbing growth in toxic algae blooms. The fertilizers serve as nutrients, feeding the plankton that fuels colorful but potentially deadly algae blooms. Red tides carrying different forms of toxic algae have been plaguing the Florida coast for months, where tons of dead fish have washed ashore, as well as dead turtles and manatees, also forcing cancellation of a Beach Fest event. Red tides can last for days, weeks, or even months, and unfortunately, so far, experts have not predicted when the current wave of toxic red tides off California's coast may end. For San Diego beachgoers, the red tide toxins are an added frustration after months of closures and warnings at some local beaches due to contamination from sewage spills in Tijuana, Mexico's aging sewage treatment plant. County officials have called on the federal government to declare a national emergency to free up funds to help with that source of pollution, and San Diego's congressional members are fighting to make that happen. But while a long-term fix to the Mexican sewage contamination is in the works, so far, there's no solution proposed to prevent the accelerating growth of toxic algae. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Over three-fourths of all adults arrested in San Diego County tested positive for at least one drug, and more than half of those arrested were on meth. Those are the disturbing findings of a new report by the San Diego Association of Governments, or SANDAG. The study also found high levels of mental health problems and homelessness among those arrested locally last year. Around one in three arrestees tested positive for multiple drugs in 2022. Of those who tested positive for multiple substances, 97% were positive for meth and 95% had marijuana in their systems. 21% tested positive for opiates, 11% for cocaine or crack, and 6% for PCP. Nearly half of those arrested also reported abusing prescription drugs, particularly tranquilizers and fentanyl. Following a surge in fentanyl deaths locally in recent years, law enforcement has warned that many street drugs have been laced with fentanyl. The SANDAG study found that 86% of arrestees said they would not purchase fentanyl, but 35% said they used a drug that they believed contained fentanyl without knowing it. Other notable findings in the SANDAG study report are that 40% of those arrested reported being diagnosed with a mental health disorder. 65% of arrestees have experienced homelessness, and 29% of arrestees said that they had committed a crime to support their drug use. SANDAG principal criminal justice researcher Octavio Rodriguez says an important characteristic of this report is looking at the underlying factors and needs that these arrestees have that can help prevent rearrests. The report's findings highlight the need to address the root causes of incarceration, including mental illness, drug use, and homelessness, as well as for programs such as addiction treatment to reduce recidivism and save lives. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Derek Wilton.
The County of San Diego has issued a revised draft environmental impact report on the proposed Cottonwood sand mine. The public has until August 14th at 4 p.m. to submit comments on the revised EIR for this very controversial project. The county will also hold an in-person public meeting regarding the recirculated draft EIR on July 25th at 6:30 p.m. at Hillsdale Middle School in Rancho San Diego. The EIR was revised after leaders of the Stop Cottonwood Sandmine Coalition called the earlier EIR draft a flawed document that failed to adequately address significant project impacts on people, wildlife, water, air, and roads, and for not proposing adequate mitigation or alternatives. Now, the proposed mining would occur along the Sweetwater River on 214 acres of the present Cottonwood Golf Course site, near homes and businesses, and immediately upstream from a federal wildlife reserve. Links for the project's original and revised EIR can be found on our website at eastcountymagazine.org, that's in our Green Scene section, along with information on how to submit comments via email before that August 1st deadline. You can also find this information on the County Planning Department's website and on the StopCottonwoodSandMine.com site. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The pandemic-era exceptions that allowed many students access to CalFresh food benefits without having to work 20 hours a week expired in June, leaving many students in the lurch. CalFresh benefits range from $23 to $281 a month for a one-person household, and data showed 127,000 students were enrolled before the pandemic. Carrie Welton with the Institute for College Access and Success says the work requirements discourage CalFresh recipients from enrolling and make it much harder for low-income students to devote themselves to their studies.
The student rules were implemented in the 70s over fears that students who looked temporarily poor because they were enrolled in college but were still receiving support from their parents could get access to CalFresh. There's actually no data to suggest that that is the case.
In June, California Congressman Jimmy Gomez introduced the EATS Act of 2023, which would count college enrollment as satisfying the work requirement for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, which was renamed CalFresh in the Golden State. However, the bill faces an uphill battle with Republicans who recently made expansion of work requirements for food benefits a condition of raising the debt ceiling. Brandy Seminero is co-director of the CalFresh Outreach Higher Ed Project, a statewide initiative based at Cal State Chico. She says the government should make it easier for low-income students to afford the basics while in college.
We really see it as employment and training for students to attend college, expand their skills, and get additional training for future jobs to expand their income and contribute more to society as a whole. So we definitely see it as satisfying that requirement.
A study from Georgetown University found that people who earn an associate's degree make 25% more over their lifetimes compared with people who only have a high school diploma, and those with a bachelor's degree earn, on average, 75% more. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A man armed with knives, a hatchet, and dumbbell weights threatened to harm people, including deputies, inside the Walmart store in Santee on July 2nd, prompting a 7-hour standoff with law enforcement. The 22-year-old man reportedly climbed on top of shelves in the sporting goods department, armed himself with workout dumbbells, and threatened to use them as weapons. He told employees he wanted deputies to shoot him, says Lieutenant Christopher Galve with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department. The Walmart store was evacuated and closed down for hours. The sheriff's SWAT team and crisis negotiations team were called to assist. During negotiations, the man walked toward deputies with a raised hatchet and told them to shoot him, according to the sheriff's department. Fortunately, deputies realized the man was experiencing a mental health crisis and used de-escalation techniques instead of lethal force. The crisis negotiation team was able to negotiate a peaceful surrender and nobody was hurt. The man was taken into custody and transported to a hospital for a mental health evaluation. If you or anybody you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, help is available by calling 988. Now out in Lemon Grove, 29-year-old Mario Milton has been arrested on suspicion of setting a house fire on Taft Street with a torch over the holiday weekend after attacking a male resident with a knife, says Sergeant Jason Phillips with the Sheriff's Department. The fire was started in a van and spread to the structure, according to Heartland Fire and Rescue spokesman Andy Keller. Deputies found the victim in the backyard and applied a tourniquet to his leg, removing him to a safe distance from the fire. The man was taken to a hospital for treatment. While firefighters were mopping up the fire, a dog, unfortunately, was found dead inside the home. The suspect has been charged with arson, assault with a deadly weapon, and cruelty to animals, among other crimes. Heartland Fire estimates the house suffered $500,000 in damages. On July 4th, around 10 o'clock at night, two people suffered gunshot wounds in Spring Valley and one died. Deputies responded to a call reporting gunshots on Central Avenue, where they found a man in the middle of the street with multiple gunshot wounds to his upper torso. Despite medical aid provided by deputies and emergency medical responders, the man died at the scene. A second victim went to a hospital on his own for treatment of a gunshot wound to his arm, which is not considered life-threatening. Lieutenant Joseph Janjura says the shooting remains under investigation and that the motive and circumstances are not yet clear. Anyone with information is asked to call the Sheriff's Homicide Unit at 858-285-6330, or you can leave an anonymous tip by calling Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8800. 8477.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf. We interview creative minds and share their ideas. Here's your host, Annette Tour.
Welcome to East County Magazine Bookshelf. I'm your host, Annette Tour. My guest today is Dr. Thomas Gabor. Dr. Thomas Gabor is president of Thomas Gabor LLC, a criminal justice consulting firm based in Florida. He has served as a professor of criminology for 30 years at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He holds a doctorate from Ohio State University and has received the American Society of Criminology's Jean Carte Prize for his research in crime displacement. He is recognized both nationally and internationally as an expert in the areas of firearms and public safety, armed robbery, and crime prevention. He has over 200 publications and articles, including several books. He's listed among the most influential criminologists by a study published in the British Journal of Criminology. The Department of Homeland Security has designated him as an individual of extraordinary ability. Dr. Gabor, I am so honored to have you, and welcome to East County Magazine Bookshelf.
Thank you, Annette. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So today we are going to talk about your book, American Carnage, Shattering the Myths That Fuel Gun Violence, which you co-authored with Fred Gutenberg. For those of you who don't know, Fred Gutenberg is an American activist against gun violence whose 14-year-old daughter, Jamie Gutenberg, was murdered in the Parkland High School shooting in Florida in 2018. So I have a few questions for you. The first question I'm curious about is, how did you get interested in criminology?
Well, I was studying sociology in Montreal, and I took a course on the sociology of deviant behavior, basically people who are outsiders, whether they're involved with the criminal justice system or some way different. And I was very fascinated by the course, liked the professor, and I think one of the other reasons that I'm involved in the field, being a former refugee, sometimes felt as an outsider myself, so I think I could identify a little better than some with those who are caught in the web of the justice system. So that's where my interest comes.
Fascinating. Well, I was reading the book, and I have to say the teacher in me just highlighted and annotated, because there is so much information here, and you really bring fiction to fact. So one of the questions I wanted to have, bring a little history, is to start off, I was surprised that in the book that it states that in the Wild Wild West, or the American frontier, there were strict gun laws back in those days. Could you give a few examples of what has changed over the years?
Yes, and that is one of the greatest myths in our book. And many people refer to it as a foundational myth, because there are all these misconceptions about the founding of this society. And in fact, from the revolutionary period to the frontier days, there was generally more strict gun control in some ways than today. An example would be that in the mid-19th century to the end of the 19th century, virtually every state outlawed the carrying of concealed weapons. And now today, by contrast, beginning in the 80s, there were, at the behest and promotion of the gun lobby, from the 80s on, we've had these right to carry laws. And so now in every state, you can carry a firearm. And we've also started removing the necessity for getting a permit to carry. So in 26 states now, and counting, Florida is the 26th, by the way, and it's the law is coming into effect on July 1st. There is no requirement. You can carry a firearm without any training, any knowledge of guns, any knowledge of the law and when it's appropriate to use lethal force. So, you know, the gun lobby tries to give this impression that by deregulating gun carrying, for example, that we're returning to our roots, when in fact, it's not the case at all. And there was strict gun control, as you say, even in the Old West, in places like Dodge City and Tombstone, Arizona. So there are many misconceptions, but that's the biggest one. So really, some of the laws, especially pertaining to the carrying of guns, are far more extreme today.
Wow. Let's talk about the myth in your book that states that an armed society is a polite society. How often are people killed by their own guns?
Well, people are killed by their own guns over 50% of cases of lethal episodes involving guns. So the last year for which we have complete data on firearm deaths in this country indicates that we have over 48,000 gun deaths a year. Over half of those are suicides. So doing some quick math, about 25,000 or so individuals kill themselves each year with firearms. And people may say, you know, there's a misconception that somebody who is determined to kill themselves will do so eventually. But in fact, we know from suicidologists, people who study suicides, that the vast majority of people who attempt suicides don't attempt it again, that they don't have a strong desire to die, but feel overwhelmed by some crisis that they're going through. So if they attempt suicide once with firearms, there's close to 90% chance that they will kill themselves. Whereas if they use drugs and so forth and overdose, it's about 2 or 3%. So firearms are the most lethal way of committing suicide. So it's very preventable.
One common statement we hear over and over again is the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. How often do gun owners actually prevent crimes in relation to committing crimes?
Not often relative to the number of crimes that are committed with firearms and harms. So first, if you look at mass shootings, there was one study done by the FBI that found of 160 what they call active shooter incidents in public, only in one case was the shooting thwarted by an armed civilian. And that armed civilian happened to have a military background. So it doesn't happen often. And now, in general, I'll give you one number in one study, a real credible study that looked at gun homicides involving guns kept in the home. For every time an intruder is shot by a homeowner, there are 22 times as many cases in which the gun is turned on somebody in that household. So there's either a domestic shooting, a suicide attempt, or some tragic accident within the home. So yes, there are cases where guns are used in self-defense, but there are far more cases in which these guns are turned on family members and that, you know, some criminal action takes place or suicide. So therefore, it's the reason we say that there is no net benefit of gun ownership in society as a whole.
Now, am I correct with the statistics that actually 70% of Americans do not own guns? That means only 30% of Americans are gun owners?
Absolutely. And that's another misconception, you know, around the world. And even Americans are surprised by that statistic. You know, we're viewed as a nation, not just awash in guns, but with a uniformly having a gun lust or gun fetish, when in fact, as you say, only about a third of Americans, and it's been declining. There was a little bit of an upsurge during the pandemic, because sometimes Americans, due to fear, insecurity, arm themselves, and we have some new gun owners in the country, but two-thirds still do not own a firearm. And then if we look at within the gun-owning community, there's a subgroup that's about 6% of the U.S. population that owns two-thirds of the guns in this country. So there's a real concentration of ownership. And the folks that we might call extremists in this area, they're a very small percentage of gun owners. Why is it important to point that out? First of all, most of us are not gun owners, and we too have rights, you know, including the right to life, which, among other things, was enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. But as well, that most gun owners, too, are not extremists and support some basic measures to reduce gun violence. So we have this relatively small minority in the country with disproportionate influence on the political level, and manage with the help of the gun lobby to keep, you know, fairly weak laws in place in a lot of the country.
Guns have always been around. Why only in the last 30 years are there so many mass school shootings? What has changed?
Well, there is an epidemic of, first of all, loneliness, but also of depression and even suicide among young people. There's been a strong increase, quite striking increase with respect to suicide among the young. You know, and there's a lot of evidence that young people are less tethered to society today than they used to be. They're less likely to participate in, say, afternoon and other, or after school and other organized programs. And people who are socially isolated with fewer friends and so forth. So that might explain some of the motive for acting out. I think, now why do they act out in the way that they sometimes do with mass shootings? Well, first of all, guns, especially these weapons of war, are far more available today than they were 20 years ago. 20 years ago, 2% of gun sales were of this AR-15 variety. Today, it's 25%. So you have some conditions that lead young people to be more desperate. They also draw cues from people before them who've engaged in mass shooting. So it's kind of contagious. We're in a cycle where, you know, young people are emulating previous shooters, and then they're enabled by easy access to firearms, especially these deadly firearms that are more deadly, I should say, than were available in the past.
I suppose this ties into the topic of mental illness, because you hear every time there is a mass shooting, then the topic of mental illness comes up. Is there a disconnection or loneliness in society that triggers this violence in people?
Well, again, you know, every indication is that people have fewer friends. I just saw a survey that showed that adults as a whole, 25% fewer adults today than, say, 20 years ago, can say that they have five or more friends. So again, people are getting more isolated. Now, you know, the pandemic, which leads people to work more remotely, is in some ways further isolating individuals. So that's one of the downsides. I know there are upsides to working remotely. And so, you know, all these factors play into it. But it's, you know, isolation is a big factor. Now, for example, we have, just by example, you look at people like Cruz, the shooter in Florida, and the Parkland shooting, and you look at the shooter at the Sandy Hook shooting. These were two very socially isolated individuals. So they're not all that way. There are mass shootings for a whole lot of other reasons, including workplace-related shootings. You have conflicts between groups and other factors, but there's an element that commits these random shootings and who is or are socially isolated. There's even a group that referred to them as incels, I-N-C-E-L-S, involuntary celibate, which refers to these socially awkward individuals who don't fit into society and are unable to find the social partner, an intimate partner. And a number of these individuals have struck back at society. You may recall, as a former Montrealer yourself, that there was this horrible shooting at the University of Montreal back in 1989. And the fellow went into the School of Engineering and separated the men from the women and started shooting. He murdered 15 women attending school. And when we looked at his past, he shared some of those frustrations. He had anger against women. He blamed women for all his problems and basically the problems around the world. So there is a category of shooter that fits into that profile.
Yes, I remember that horrible shooting and hearing about it and being shocked. And I think the number one comment was, this doesn't happen in Canada. Mm-hmm. This only happens in the United States. I want to talk about another myth that you mentioned in your book, which people probably have heard of, is guns don't kill people, people kill people. And potentially any good guy could turn to a bad guy. So what percentage of homicides are spontaneous versus planned out?
The majority of homicides are not what we call premeditated. They are not. And so whether they are due to arguments, that's the number one reason, motive for homicide, some kind of dispute between individuals or groups of people. Another big category are felony killings where somebody commits a robbery, a rape, or some other crime, and they didn't intend to, but they eventually, for some reason, they end up killing the victim or a witness. So the vast majority of killings are relatively spontaneous. And that's why the presence or absence of guns becomes more consequential. Because, you know, you have the argument again from the gun lobby and their allies that, you know, if somebody wants to kill, they can, and they will eventually kill another person. And they can, you can even kill with a frozen ham or a hammer and so on. And while that's true, since most killing is rather spontaneous, whether an individual has a deadly weapon, such as a gun, or no weapons at all, or possibly a knife in their possession, it makes all the difference in the world. Because we know, for example, when we compare gun attacks with knife attacks, there's a gun attack is at least three times as likely to end up in death and become a homicide than a knife attack. So it's really very consequential, the fact that, first of all, most killings are not premeditated. And second of all, the presence or absence of lethal weapons is very consequential in assaults.
What would you say to, there are countries such as Finland, Canada, and Switzerland with relatively high gun ownership and low crime rates. How are these countries different than the U.S.?
There are massive differences in that. Well, first of all, gun ownership in the U.S. is still an outlier. So we have about 120 guns for every 100 people. And none of the countries you mentioned, really no country in the world comes close to U.S. in terms of its level of privately held firearms. But there are other significant differences. Most advanced countries have a system of licensing whereby there's more of a stronger vetting of who should and should not own guns. And there are interviews with law enforcement, reference checks, and even mandatory training on the part of gun owners. In the U.S., we have a very weak background check system, in my view. It's not just weak because people who buy in the private market don't have to pass a background check at all. But the background check system, when one buys from a dealer, is about a two-minute check of three FBI databases. So if a person doesn't have a criminal conviction, they might show a lot of disturbing behaviors, like Nicholas Cruz, for example, who committed the Parkland shooting. But and every of his, one of his schoolmates pretty well said he would be the leading candidate to be a school shooter. But he, strictly speaking, didn't have a criminal conviction, a felony conviction, and therefore could still go and purchase his firearm. So the background check system is much weaker. Other countries have a licensing system. Another way that the U.S. is an outlier is it's permissible to own guns for self-protection. This isn't the case in Canada, for example. In Canada, you have to make a very strong case to carry guns for the purpose of self-protection. You have to prove that you are in imminent danger of death, say from an estranged spouse, and that nobody, law enforcement or nobody else, can protect you. So you have a strong onus on the individual. Here it's an entitlement to own a gun for self-protection. And so those weapons are handled very differently. And we have a lot more gun carrying than is the case in other countries. In many countries, there aren't many handguns, or they're considered restricted weapons. So there's some very fundamental differences. We have more guns, we have more gun carrying, we have gun carrying for the purposes of self-protection, we have poorer vetting, and we don't have mandatory training like other countries. And we also don't have, final point I'd make here is, we don't have a national safe storage law that requires people to store guns, especially out of the reach of children. And other countries do have some kind of national safe storage. And there's only one state in the United States, Massachusetts, that requires every firearm in a household to be secured, locked, unloaded, and so forth. So we, in general, have very weak laws in the United States as far as storage is concerned.
80% of Americans believe in stricter gun laws. Why is it then so hard to pass these laws that will protect Americans?
First of all, we have a very much a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, which has passed some laws, rulings that some people would say distorts the meaning of the Second Amendment, and is leading to many laws that are on the books in different states to be challenged. So even assault weapons bans are being challenged because of the interpretation of the Second Amendment. So that's one issue. And there's certainly the conservative majority court today is not representative of the general population. There's also a gun lobby that we've had that, while somewhat weakened these days due to scandal, the NRA in particular, they were one of the most powerful lobbies in the country and still have the ability to mobilize their members so that legislators are afraid of them and know that, you know, if they propose strong gun laws, the gun lobby will mobilize their constituents against them. So they're a very powerful lobby group. And finally, in general, gun owners as a whole tend to be more active politically than activists, say, on the other side of this issue. They are more likely to donate to political campaigns, they're much more vocal, they contact their representatives more often. So they are much single issue voters frequently, and much more influential and active than folks who wish to see change in this area. And it's why I urge people who want to see change to get as active as those on the other side of this debate, because we are in the majority. As you've pointed out, recent polls, even the Fox News poll, found that 80% or more of Americans are in favor of many of the measures that we seek, from expanding background checks to these red flag laws, to raising the age for gun purchases, and so on. So if the majority was to become far more active and far more vocal, that could make a significant difference. Because just to give you an example, Australia had a major change in 1996 following a massacre there of 35 people. The country, while having strong roots in terms of gun ownership, a frontier, a strong gun lobby, there were many similarities with the United States. 90% of the population demanded change. And there was a conservative government, a new government, that brought about change and worked with the states there in Australia to bring about national reform in this area. So outrage on a wide scale is really important. And I think we're starting to get closer, but we're not quite there in the United States.
Well, that's all the time we have today, Dr. Gabor. It has been my honor to speak with you. The book is American Carnage, Shattering the Myths That Fuel Gun Violence. Thank you for being on the show, and best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you, Annette. It's been really nice to be with you today.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This week's Destination East County features some fun and amazing events, including Camel Farm Tours in Ramona, Pine Valley Days, and the Pine Valley Parade, Team on a Trek at Grossmont Center, a Starfest in Julian, Cajon Classic Cruises, Santee Summer Concerts, and the Mount Helix Food and Wine Festival.
Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona is offering farm tours on July 15th and July 29th from 12 noon to 2 p.m. The tour includes a camel and bird show, feeding camels and miniature sheep, along with other farm attractions and an option to ride a camel. For tickets and reservations, you can visit cameldairy.com.
The Pine Valley community celebrates Pine Valley Days July 28th and 29th. The fun starts with a deep pit barbecue Friday night from 5 to 9 p.m. at Pine Valley Park, with seasoned pork slow cooked for 24 hours or chicken plates. There will also be a beer garden and t-shirts. From 6 to 9:30, there will be live music by the Big Sky Moon Band and dancing at the gazebo in the park. And then on Saturday, July 29th at 9 a.m., the parade starts along Old Highway 80 just before Pine Valley Road. The parade is a fun family event filled with floats, horses, classic cars, stilt walkers, balloon artists, and more. After the parade will be the annual Pine Valley Days event at the park, and there you can enjoy live music by multiple bands, bounce houses, food, and shopping. For more information, you can check out pinevalleydays.com or the Pine Valley Days parade page on Facebook. You're invited to bring friends, form a team with a creative name, and vie for prizes in fun challenges at stations across Grossmont Center in La Mesa on July 28th from 4 to 7 p.m. It's all part of Team on a Trek, an event to raise funds for the nonprofit San Diego Oasis Learning and Wellness Centers. The fun will also include music, entertainment, and awards. Think of it as an amazing race type of event, but for all ages and levels. Teams are encouraged to show some spirit and get silly, organizers say. There will be awards such as Best Costume, Best Team Name, and Most Spirited. Multi-generational teams are encouraged. There is a fee for teams to enter, and you can register for Team on a Trek at the San Diego Oasis website. That's san-diego.oasisnet.org, or just Google San Diego Oasis.
The Julian Star Fest returns August 11th and 12th. This year's festivities include a public star party on Saturday night, August 12th, camping availability for tent and RV campers, astronomy games and crafts for kids, exhibits by major telescope and accessory vendors, food and beverage vendors. On Saturday only, there will be a raffle for donated astronomy equipment, plus an optional behind-the-scenes tour of the world-famous Mount Laguna Observatory. All proceeds from the event are used to help fund the San Diego Astronomy Association's ongoing community educational efforts. Learn more at julianstarfest.com.
Cajon Classic Cruises continue along Main Street in downtown El Cajon this summer. The car shows are held each Wednesday from 5 to 7:30 p.m. all summer long. The city also hosts outdoor concerts in the park, on Prescott Promenade, in the same area along Main Street every Friday night from 6 to 8 p.m. now through September. You can bring a picnic dinner or arrive early to dine at one of the restaurants nearby. Find a full list of weekly car show themes and the lineup of concert bands at downtownelcajon.com.
Santee officials say it's music to their ears. The Santee's summer concerts taking stage for outdoor concerts on Thursday nights through August 17th in Town Center Park.
You're invited to don your cowboy boots and wrangle up the gang for the Mount Helix Food and Wine Festival on the evening of August 19th. This year's event features a Wild West theme, food and wine tasting from local restaurants and beverage companies, as well as artists, live and silent auctions, live music, sunset views from atop Mount Helix, and dancing under the stars. For tickets, visit mounthelixpark.org.
That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around, East County.
This is Ed Barreno with East County Magazine on KNSJ with some grilling safety tips. July, August, and right into Labor Day, we use our barbecue grills more than any other months. Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, East County Magazine's in-house fire chief and columnist, says that firefighters respond to many structure and wild land fires that involve barbecues around this time of year. He adds, quote, "We also treat many victims for injuries related to barbecues. Barbecue safety means sending the right smoke signal, and that signal is safety," unquote. While gas grills contribute to a higher number of home fires than their charcoal counterparts, all grills pose a risk for fires and burns. Grills should be placed well away from the home and decks, far from under the eaves or overhanging branches and vegetation. Other grilling safety tips from the National Fire Protection Association are as follows. 1. Propane and charcoal grills should only be used outdoors. 2. Keep children and pets at least 3 feet away from the grilling area. 3. Keep your grill clean by removing grease or fat buildup from the grills and in trays below the grill. 4. Never leave your grill unattended. Always make sure your gas grill lid is open before igniting it. 5. If you smell gas while cooking, immediately get away from the grill and call the fire department. Do not move the grill. If the flame goes out, turn the grill and gas off and wait at least 15 minutes before relighting it. 6. When using a starter fluid, use only charcoal starter fluid. Never add any other flammable liquids to the fire. Keep charcoal fluid out of the reach of children and away from heat sources. When you are finished grilling, let the coals completely cool before disposing of them in a metal container. And finally, use common sense and grill safely.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime, strolling through the shady lanes with your baby mine. You hold her hand and she holds yours, and that's a very good sign that she's your tootsie wootsie in the good old summertime.
With summer just around the corner, the County of San Diego has opened its annual Cool Zones program, giving people free, safe, air-conditioned sanctuaries to escape extreme heat. The county created the Cool Zone program 2 decades ago to give older adults, people with disabilities, and those with health concerns that could be complicated by effects of extreme heat. The program will run from June 1st through October 31st. Sites include the county's 33 branch libraries, community centers, and other locations across the county, including here in East County. A complete list of Cool Zone sites, hours, and locations is located online at coolzones.org. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.